Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Dammit. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel, and joining me on the phone, Dr. Penny Sartori. Now, Penny has written a book called The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences. She worked as a nurse in a British hospital for over 20 years, 17 of those in intensive care, and she has become an expert sort of in the field of NDEs, as we call them, with near-death experiences. Thank you so much for being on the program, Penny.
Oh, hi, Jen. It's lovely to be with you.
So I've been engulfing myself in your work and sort of watching everything I can, from reading your book to videos. And it's really fun to see your journey and to note that this happened to you. You got interested in this research because of your own experiences as a nurse with intensive care and watching someone pass away. For myself, it was watching two people very close to me die. When you watch someone take their last breath, you start to wonder, where are they? What does it all mean? And so that's sort of how this journey started for you, isn't it?
It was, yeah, absolutely. And I can remember it was working a night shift, and I was looking after this man in intensive care, and he had a particularly unpleasant and prolonged death. And we connected, and our eyes connected, and it almost felt as if I'd swapped places with him, and I could feel what he was going through. And that really upset me, and for the rest of the night shift, that's all I could think about. And the following day, when I went home from work, I kind of, I couldn't sleep because he was on my mind. And when I phoned up to find out how he was doing, he'd actually died. And that really had a big impact on me. And every time I went into work after that, I was thinking, well, am I saving lives in the way that I thought I was, or am I just prolonging suffering, you know? And it made me think about death, and I thought, you know, is death that bad that we have to put patients through this at the end of their life? And that just started me off thinking all these different thoughts, and I questioned everything, and then I just thought, well, I'm working in the ideal place, really. I could do my own research into this, and that's what I decided to do. And as soon as I made that kind of decision, it's as if any obstacles that could have been in the way just disappeared, and it was just like someone had put a red carpet out, and all I had to do was walk along that carpet, you know?
Oh, that's so great, because I truly feel that when you are on the path you're supposed to be on, that flow and ease and grace really take over. And so if you're finding all these hiccups and all these, you know, slammed doors, then perhaps that's not the path, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. And I totally felt like the whole time I was doing my research, I was totally in the flow, totally. And if there was some times when I was getting a little bit disheartened, I'd come across a patient who'd have a really interesting experience. And then my momentum picked back up again. It was really incredible. And then when my research finished after the end of the data collection, and then I'd written it all up, I was at a loss a bit as well, you know, and that flow kind of fell back because I wasn't doing it anymore. It was really strange coming to terms with finishing the research as well.
Well, just know that so many people have gained so much with ease and knowledge through your research. A few points I want to bring up, which I think is so important. You talk about, you know, science, spirituality, and health, and how maybe nurses and doctors should be taking into account the spiritual aspect of their patients, not to mention the bedside manner and all the possibilities. Do you think that we don't embrace it more in the medical community because of fear of lawsuits? Is that really what it is, or is it more just the denial that this is scientifically possible by so many?
I think it's the denial, really, that it's scientifically possible. You know, we've been brought up with this scientific paradigm, and anything that you can't measure doesn't really kind of come into the equation much. You know, it's not given much notice at all. And I know, from my own perspective, you know, my nurse training was very scientific, so initially I was a little bit skeptical myself. And it's only through literally having to have an open mind that, and actually exploring all possibilities and talking to patients who'd actually had the experience, you know, that really made me realize, yeah, that there's something to this. So I think it's more because of the scientific training that is embedded with it for all doctors and nurses. And I think what I've noticed, though, is that's beginning to change. And thankfully, attitudes to near-death experiences are really, really broadening, and people are really starting to take them seriously now, thankfully.
Yes, and I think with the more doctors, medical doctors, orthopedic surgeons, MDs, that actually have them as well, right? And come out and talk about them. Like, you've done research on lots of them. You personally haven't had a near-death experience, but all the dozens of people that you've interviewed, and now hundreds, it's compiling this data. I interviewed Dr. Mary Neal, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
And so here she is, an orthopedic surgeon who was dead for, you know, she says 30 minutes with no oxygen. That's pretty startling. And her husband, also a surgeon and a doctor, was there to witness this, what happened for her. And so now she says she comes back, and she was told she had to come back, right? Getting kicked out of heaven. But she said she knew she was supposed to tell everybody who would listen her story, and especially in hospitals. So she travels around, you know, now the world. It used to be just in the United States, but she travels around to talk to hospitals, to other doctors and people in the medical community. And she says sometimes only one person will show up, and sometimes 70. She never knows, but even just one is making a difference. Are you seeing more, you know, in your travels now that you have this book under your belt, are you seeing that more people in the medical community are actually hearing you out?
Yes, definitely. You know, I've seen a huge change in attitude, certainly where I worked when I began my research. Mm-hmm. They were making jokes about what I was doing initially. But then as the research progressed, they could see that it was going to be of benefit for patient care. And the doctors really embraced it, and they were very supportive, you know. Mm-hmm. And also I'm seeing it on a wider scale as well. And it's great, because when I first started the research, trying to find other people as well outside of the hospital, mm-hmm. who would also share the experience with me, was very difficult. And doctors wouldn't talk about the experience, but afterwards what I found is that actually some of the doctors approached me, and they started to tell me about experiences or mm-hmm. anomalous experiences that they had come across throughout their work. And also one or two doctors said, well, actually, I had a near-death experience, but I didn't want to tell anyone about it, and I was afraid to tell you about it. Mm-hmm. And it's really bizarre that they were working with me at the time, but it took another few years before they would actually come and discuss it with me as well. So, you know, I'm seeing a huge shift in attitude, where people are beginning to become more open about the experiences. And certainly with Dr. Mary Neal and Dr. Eben Alexander, Dr. Rajiv Party talking very publicly about their own experiences, it's making people sit up a bit more now as well.
I'm going to put another book on your radar. I interviewed a gentleman named Dr. Scott Kolbaba, K-O-L-B-A-B-A, and he is a MD and a physician here in the Chicago area. And he wrote a book called Physicians Untold Stories. And he got 26, as he calls them, regular docs, you know, just regular MDs, some of them OBGYN, some of them orthopedic surgeons, family practice, but doctors that aren't in the integrative medicine space. And I'm not knocking that, because I love the integrative medicine space, but he's saying that these are the kind of doctors that wouldn't normally be talking about this stuff that went on the record. And he convinced them, because he said, I'm not going to put this book out unless you guys go on the record. And he is hopeful that by more MDs and more people in the hospital system coming out with these stories that everybody already knows about in the hospital system, right? Like you talk about when you started off as a nurse and you came onto your shift, and the one nurse was talking about, oh, well, this gentleman's going to go probably by morning. You know, he's already talking to his mom on the other side, as if, you know, she were ordering breakfast. It was such a normal thing to say. And you were like, what?
I know. I was totally shocked. I thought they were trying to spook me, because it was my first day.
Right.
But it was just something that's commonly accepted amongst nurses, you know, because you see it so often. It's incredible. Right.
So now that you've done so many of these interviews with people who've had these experiences, you know, let's talk about a lot of the through lines, right? You know, they talk about feeling unconditional love and seeing their loved ones that have passed before them. And there's the life review, which is really intense, where they feel everything that they put out. But also, so interestingly, they are almost put in the position of those that they either loved or hurt. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's right. It's as if during the life review, they're reliving episodes within their life that have passed, and they actually swap places with people they've interacted with. Mm. So, for example, some people, one man has described being in the body of another man he interacted with, and he had physically punched him, and he felt that man's pain when his hand connected with the man's jaw, and he felt the shame that man felt, and everything about it, you know, it totally gives them a different perspective on the way in which they've interacted with people, because he could see why that man was in the way that he was acting and why it had caused him to hit him. Mm-hmm. And also, as well, with people who had kind gestures, for example, the ripple effects of those are really incredible, and they're far beyond what we can see and perceive while we're in the body. And so, you know, when you're having this life review, you can perceive the effects of the way you've interacted with people. So then when they come back to life, of course, they're very mindful of the way in which they interact with people then from there on.
And often they make incredible life changes. I know that in the data, some marriages don't even survive from the people who have had near-death experiences, because they just don't live their life the same way ever again.
Yeah, that's right. It's literally as if they've died to the person who they were before, and now they're starting life afresh with a new set of values. And very often, because their values shift so much, they no longer have anything in common with their partners. And so, yeah, the divorce rate is very high after a near-death experience. And also, sometimes with the jobs that they do, they no longer connect with their kind of work that they were doing before. Mm-hmm. And very often they can leave work and they can go off and do volunteer work or transfer into the caring professions as well. So, you know, there's huge changes after these experiences.
So it's the life change of the materialistic no longer seems to be of as much value. And that, you know, it's sort of that, how much do you really need? You need to feel like you have purpose. You also talked about in your research the man who, I believe the same man who saw how he affected the man he punched, he also saw how he helped the woman with the groceries across the street and got to see, you know, that relief that brought her. These little simple gestures, we have no idea how much of a difference they make.
That's right, exactly. And it's kind of makes you reflect. It certainly made me reflect through studying the experiences, how I live my life myself, you know. So it's had a big wake-up call for me as well. So since studying the experiences, I can say that I've never felt so empowered, really. A lot of people used to say to me, Penny, you're studying death. That's really that's really morbid. And I said, no, it's not, because actually I'm a lot happier since studying it, because it's given me a totally different understanding of life. And so, you know, I think when you start to learn about death, that's when you really start to learn about life.
And what are you finding in your research, the differences between a children's near-death experience and the adults, if any?
Yeah, they're very, very similar, but in children, they're perhaps more likely to see relatives who are still living, or to see pets as well. And with the children as well, it's very important that they're kind of encouraged to express what they experienced as well, because what I found with when I've been studying this is that Dr. Melvin Morse did some research with children in the intensive care unit, mm-hmm. and he followed those children right through then about 20 years later, and he found, you know, that they were very well adjusted people as well, and that they were really happy with their life and less likely to use drugs and alcohol and things like that. Whereas if you look at some of PMH Atwater's data, mm-hmm. she found that some children, people who'd had childhood NDEs, actually turned to drugs and to alcohol. And I think for me the difference with those two samples is that Melvin Morse actually acknowledged those near-death experiences shortly after they'd been reported. Mm. And so perhaps the acknowledgement of them was what was needed for those children to fully integrate that experience into their life. So I think it's important that people are able to have that support when they're trying to make sense of this really phenomenal and profound experience as well.
That's interesting. So PMH, we've had on the program as well, PMH Atwater, who's had her own near-death experiences, but now, of course, as you know, focusing a lot on the children piece. And mm-hmm. one of the things she told me that always stuck with me, and I tell this story as often as I can, because it had such an impact. And, you know, the children aren't out at the library or comparing notes with other people who've had near-death experiences. They're a much more pure filter because they don't know that it's right or wrong or whatever. There's less judgment to the experience, right? And so she said that when she talked to several children, they noted that when they were in the light on the other side, that if somebody was praying a heartfelt prayer for someone else's well-being, the children could see it going from the person who was praying to the recipient, like a rainbow shooting from one heart to the other. Isn't that lovely? So I always tell people, send those rainbows from your heart, not those prayers like, I want more money, I need a new boyfriend. No, like a heartfelt prayer for somebody's well-being, for their health, for the longevity, for their happiness, whatever it might be, a selfless kind of prayer. And they really do, they are received energetically. Even if they aren't heard, they are felt.
Yes, absolutely. And there was another case as well, and I think it was reported by Caroline Miss, which is very similar to that, where there was a road traffic accident and a lady had had left her body and she was looking down on the traffic queue behind, and she could see people were really irate that they'd been caught up in traffic, but she was drawn to one spot, and it was almost as if there was kind of light around that spot, and in that car there was a lady praying for whoever was in that car crash. So it's really, really interesting.
It's amazing stuff. And, you know, you talked also about how sometimes the love that we have here on this side and the longing for the missing of our loved ones almost keeps them here. Explain that to our listeners. So if, you know, you're really wishing, oh, please don't go, please don't go. You know, the energy of our longing for them to stay here in the body actually sometimes prevents them from crossing over.
It does, yes. Now, I noticed this quite a lot when I worked in intensive care, and it's almost as if people have some kind of control over the time when they die, even if they're unconscious and they're not communicating with us. What I noticed is that sometimes dying people would wait for their relatives to arrive if they hadn't seen them, if they'd been abroad. They would wait for them to arrive, and then shortly after they arrived at the bedside, the person would die, or they would wait for a really special occasion. Perhaps a wedding had been planned or a christening, and as soon as that had passed, the person would then die after that. And in a few occasions, well, quite a few actually, what I noticed is that sometimes the family members would be at the bedside almost the whole day. And on the occasion where I would ask the family members if they would, you know, they were looking tired, to go and have a coffee break or something, or if I needed to do some nursing care, when the family members left the bedside and went to the canteen, that patient would often deteriorate very rapidly. And then many times I ran to the canteen to get the family back, and by the time we'd arrived at the bedside, the patient had actually died. And the way I can make sense of this really is almost as if the love of the family is what's keeping them grounded in this earth, in this place. And I think when that link is broken, it actually gives their loved one permission to go. It makes it easier for them to go, because perhaps they don't really want to go. They, you know, they want to that love as well. They feel that love. And I think when that link is then broken, it makes it easier for them to transition into death.
You know, I've interviewed a healer recently who does the healing practitioner type, Joe Ray. Have you heard of that kind of healing?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Okay, so it because hails from Japan in the early 1900s, around the 30s, actually. And it's spelled J-O-H, I believe, apostrophe R-E-I, sort of like Reiki. But, you know, Reiki's become much more commercialized and popular. And Joe Ray is a kind of healing, like, you know, from the universal source of God, or however you want to put it. But he told me that one of the things that we can do best for those on the other side in our lineage, in our family, is to pray for their healing over there. Because just because they're over there and they're, quote, closer to the light, if you will, doesn't mean they don't have work to do. They have all sorts of patterns that they're trying to, you know, learn from and be elevated spiritually and all of these things. I didn't even think of that, because we get so caught up in our world on this side and woe is me and here we are. It's difficult here, but it's heavenly there. But apparently there's some homework to do over there as well.
Well, that would make sense, actually, because if you have you read any of Dr. Michael Newton's books, Journey of Souls,
yes,
and things,
yes.
You know, he says that there is that phase once they've passed as well. So, yes, that would certainly tie in with his findings from his work as well.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's an interesting thing. And I think, yeah, that would be a lovely thing to do, to pray for the loved one as they've passed as well.
So what are your beliefs now that you've done all this research? I know that this has changed how you live your life, but has it changed what you believe for your spiritual life?
Yes, it has. And I think it's really kind of made me question what consciousness is. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, our science will tell us that, you know, we're born and we have a brain and the brain produces consciousness. And then when we die, that consciousness ends. Mm-hmm. But certainly from what I've learned with my research and the things that I've witnessed during my intensive care career have given me a completely different understanding. And what I believe now is that consciousness is non-local. And by that, I mean it's not located in the brain. And I believe that if anything, our brain acts like a transmitter or a receiver of consciousness, and it has like a filter on it. And I think there are times in our life when that filter action of the brain relaxes, mm-hmm. and we can experience this overwhelming state of consciousness, which is primary, but we're not aware of it usually because the brain just filters it out. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what makes most sense to me. So I believe that consciousness is primary and eternal, mm-hmm. and it's almost like we're spiritual beings having a temporary human experience. That's what makes most sense to me.
Yes. And also, too, those from different countries have different experiences based on how they were raised or their religious beliefs. Can you dig into that a little bit? Like, for example, somebody from India who has a near-death experience has a different greeting with the spiritual, you know, other side than somebody here from, say, the United States or the UK.
Yeah, now in India, what they tend to do is they meet Yamaduts, or who are messengers of Yama, the god of the dead. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they come across a man called Chitragupta, who is the man with the book of deeds. And that's all of the deeds of their life. And depending on what's recorded in that book, that decides the fate of where that person goes after their death. Mm-hmm. And that is a little bit analogous to our life review, really. It's reflecting on what people have done with their life and throughout their life. So it varies really according to the culture of the person as well. And so, you know, where they are more likely to see Yama, over here in the West, it's more likely to see Jesus or images of Mary and things like that. So it is very much culturally influenced. And it's almost as if people are tapping into what Carl Jung called the archetypal realm and the collective unconscious. Mm-hmm. So it's as if they're interpreting what they're seeing through their cultural filter as well.
So do you think that, have you had experiences where you've interviewed somebody where they see Jesus and they were an atheist or not a Jesus fan? Because I interviewed a gentleman who, he had a near-death experience and he was hovering over the scene and as he saw the car accident beneath him and he was in the light and he said he saw a gentleman come forth and it was Jesus, but not what he thought Jesus looked like, you know, the way they portray him in the West. But he knew this consciousness that it was Jesus, and the guy was like, well, this is great, nice to see you, Jesus, but can you show me where Buddha is? Because I'm a Buddhist.
Right, yes.
How about you? In your research, have you met people that are disappointed with the spiritual person who shows up?
Well, I kind of, one I can think of is the one of them in my hospital research. And again, he wasn't particularly religious or anything, but he said, I saw there was a man there, and he said, it might have been Jesus, but it's not what I expected Jesus to look like, because his hair was long and scruffy and needed a good combing as well. And so, you know, it wasn't what he expected. But then also I've had people who were atheists who had an experience, and after the experience, they became quite religious afterwards as well. So it kind of really changed them in a big way as well. And again, a famous example of that is Howard Storm. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Yeah, you know, it's really...
Okay, so now I wonder about the few experiences that were negative, right? Where they expressed a complete fear and panic. And so for those who feel that those weren't complete near-death experiences, right? There's an argument that, they were just kind of not all the way dead, because if they were, they would have been in the light. But then, of course, there's the religious argument that they must live a life that was immoral, so they were seeing the darkness. Talk about some of the, I don't want to say negative experiences, but experiences that left a mark in a, you know, sort of scary way.
Yes, now some of them can be distressing. And what I came across in my hospital research, there were two cases that were distressing. The first kind was the usual kind of near-death experience, but the lady interpreted it in a very distressing way, and she didn't think it was pleasant at all. She'd left her body, she was travelling towards a large expanse of water, and there was a big bridge, and she's frightened of water, and she, as she was getting closer, she was beginning to panic more, and then she could hear voices in the background as if they were laughing at her, children's voices laughing at her, and she, it was a horrible thing, and as she got closer, she was convinced that she was dead, and then all of a sudden it stopped, and she woke up in the intensive care unit. But she said to me afterwards, when she was recovering, she said there was nothing pleasant about that experience. I was convinced I was dead, and it was very distressing to her. Now, the second time case I came across was a lady who'd had a cardiac arrest, and when I asked her if she had any memories of the time she was unconscious, she began to recall that she'd seen a big lake in front of her, and there was a lady in a rowing boat, and she had a straw hat on her head, and she said she didn't know this lady, but she knew she had to get away from her. And then all of a sudden she could see some very bright colours spinning, and she said it was like fireworks, you know, Catherine wheels spinning around. And she said then I could see the mist, and she said, oh, and that's when it started to get horrible. I could sense the heat, I could feel the heat, and I could feel the flames of hell. And at that point, she said, I was looking into hell, and then she started to cry. And in fact, this was, the memory of it was so distressing for her that she began to cry hysterically, and I had to terminate the interview. And she was begging me afterwards, she said, please tell me that's not going to happen when I die. And I said, you know, the only thing I could say to reassure her was that some of these experiences start off distressing, but then they can turn into a pleasant experience as well. Right. Now, we don't really realise, we don't understand why some people do have the distressing kind, and it doesn't seem to be anything to do with their moral character either. They're much harder to kind of research these because, of course, there's some stigma attached. You know, some people, well, why did I have an unpleasant one, and so many other people have had this pleasant experience? So people are reluctant to report them, and of course the recall of them is just too distressing for them and very, very frightening.
I remember,
you know, when I was a student nurse, and it's only because I've reflected back on this now since my research. There was a lady who was dying, and every time I walked past her bedside, she was trying to jump out and grab onto us, and she would dig her nails into our flesh, and she'd say, please, don't let me die, don't let me die. I've died before, and it was horrible. And, you know, we didn't understand it. And in fact, the only way that we could treat this lady was to sedate her quite heavily, and we spoke with the family about it, and they said, well, she did have a cardiac arrest about 5 years previously. Now, since doing my research, I'm thinking, did she have a distressing kind of near-death experience when she had her cardiac arrest? It's so important that we understand these as well, so that we can give psychological support to people as they're recovering as well.
I interviewed a woman named Dina Chase Moore who had a near-death experience, and she was planning to go. She wanted to go to be with her husband because her husband had passed, and so she did all the paperwork and got her will in order and everything, and literally went in just for a very standard procedure like a hysterectomy or something, right? And there she was in the light, and she goes down what she explained, a very interesting moving walkway where she wasn't walking, but it was moving. Kind of like those things you have, walkways in the airport, right? Where you're just standing and everything's moving. And then the colors were bright, you know, super bright, and she felt unconditional love. And there was her husband at the other end, and she was going to walk across the bridge, as many people have, you know, seen the bridge, and he put up his hand and said, no, it's not your time, you have to go back. And she was like, do you know how much paperwork I did to get here? no, I'm coming with you. And he said, no, you have to go back, you have to be with our children, it's not your time, you have work to do. Why do you think that some people are allowed in, so to speak? Some people are brought back through distress, and then they're mad when they get back, like, wait, do you know where I was? Why did you bring me back? And then others come back with a mission, like Dr. Mary Neal, Dina Chase Moore, where they know that their work isn't done, and it's that they've got to buckle down and do it.
Yeah, that's a difficult one because, you know, I've had that question asked so many times, it's really hard to answer. So, you know, some people actually do go over and don't come back.
Yeah.
And then some are sent back. And when they come back, they have that sense of purpose and sense of mission, but they don't always know what it is. Well, the majority of people don't know what it is. And they it's almost like they're searching for what their mission is as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes I think, is their purpose just simply to share their experience, because it's educating people as well? And I think, you know, anyone who shares their experience is being incredibly brave, and they're also doing such a service to humanity because they are educating everyone as well.
Let's talk about shared NDEs, because I find this one so fascinating. When somebody is having symptoms or about to cross over, and then a loved one, maybe a daughter or a sibling or somebody very close to their heart, has a physical reaction and actually goes through the process as well. Let's talk about some of that in your research.
Oh, yes. Now, this is fascinating to me. And the first time I became aware of it was when a man contacted me at the university, and he said, look, I had this experience and I really don't understand it. It happened when my wife died. Now, his wife was terminally ill and she was at the end stages, and they were in the hospital with her, and the daughter was at the head of the bed and she was stroking her mum's forehead, and the husband was at the side holding her hand, and the son was there as well on the other side. And all of a sudden he said, my daughter said, look, can you see mum? She's walking on a path. Mm-hmm. And with that, he said, this big vision opened up in front of him, and he was walking alongside this path with his wife. Mm-hmm. And he could only go so far, and then in the distance they could see a group of people, and there was a big light behind them, and out of this group of people stood a man who was very, very tall, and his wife continued along this path, and the man held out his arms expectantly in a hug, for a hug. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they connected and there was this all-embracing hug, he said he'd never felt such peace in his life and this deep unconditional love. Mm-hmm. And he said then after that, the vision disappeared and he was back in the hospital room. Mm-hmm. And he said that my wife had actually died at that point. And he said this has just filled us all with such deep emotion. He said it was just pure joy. And he said what should have been the saddest day of my life, because my wife had just died, he said I had this big smile on my face, and also the daughter as well. Now, I spoke to the daughter independently, and she said, you know, I have absolutely no fear of death after that experience. She said, I can't explain it. I don't know what it was, but it gave me such peace to be there as my mother was dying and share that partial journey with her. Mm. And
then they were worried about being too cheerful when she passed. I remember that part as well.
That's right. He said, you know, we were thinking the nurses were going to think that we were insensitive, you know?
Oh, that's so funny. Well, you know, there also, too, you talk about somebody who had a near-death experience with, he had a physical sort of deformed hand from cerebral palsy. And then after his NDE came back and his hand could open all the way. And this is a scientific head-scratcher for sure. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Definitely. Now, this happened in part of my hospital research, mm-hmm. so it's fully documented with the backing of the medical notes as well. And during his near-death experience, he had the out-of-body component where he accurately described the actions of the nurses and the doctors and the physios. But he also went up then and had the near-death experience where he met this Jesus-type figure and deceased family members. Mm-hmm. But when he came back to life, and I was interviewing him, he misinterpreted one of my questions. And, you know, if he hadn't misinterpreted the question, I would have missed this really important aspect. I said to him, when you were out of your body, was there anything that you could do that you can't normally do? And he just opened out his hand, he held it up, and he said, look, I can open out my hand.
Mm.
Now, I didn't realize the significance of this at the time, but this man has cerebral palsy. So for 60 years of his life, his right hand had been in that permanently contracted position. So when I discussed this with the doctors and the physiotherapists, they said that should not be possible. They didn't believe me at first. They said, no, there's no way, because the tendons would be in a permanently shortened position. Mm-hmm. So they said, you know, in order for him to open out his hand, he'd have to have some surgery to release the tendons. But he didn't have any surgery. I checked his medical notes. He didn't have any physiotherapy to his hand, and there's no medical explanation for this. And his sister has written a signed statement to say that he's never been able to open out his hand. And so no one can explain it, you know. And that, to me, is fascinating, because if we understood the mechanism behind that, there are so many other people out there who could benefit from that, you know.
No kidding. It's so true. And so I'm wondering what you think, Penny, as what do you feel about energy work and people who claim to be mediums or psychics or people who go to them for counsel, you know, just to kind of get through life on this side? Are you a believer in alternative therapies such as Reiki or energy work or Qigong in addition to their medical treatment? And are you a believer of mediums or psychics?
Very much so, in especially with energy healing as well, because I have direct experience of this, and I go every month to have energy healing, and it really does make such a profound difference to my well-being and my sanity as well, you know, and the crazy lives that we lead and busy lifestyles and everything. And, you know, I really do cherish the energy healing that I have. And yes, I've seen huge differences as well in people who have been really, really kind of depressed and anxious in their life and have had great grief as well. And they've been to have energy healing themselves. And I've noticed a massive difference in those people. And that's one thing that I would really like to do in the future, is to do some more research around this as well. It would be lovely to follow the journey of someone who's not ever had any energy healing, and to go with them when they start a treatment of energy healing and follow them through over the course of a few months. You know, it would be great to see if there was a measurable outcome in the way that they're feeling as well. So yes, I think definitely with energy healing, there's something really important that we should be investigating further. And also with psychics and mediums, you know, I think that's really fascinating as well. And in fact, many people who have a near-death experience tend to develop those tendencies anyway after the experience. And certainly I know recently a friend of mine went to see a medium, and she was given information that there's no way that medium would have known about at all. This is something that is, you know, had been that only my friend knew about. And yet this medium picked up on it and told her that information. So again, I think, you know, it's really important that we do more research into these as well.
Yeah, and I caution people also to do their research to make sure that you are getting a practitioner, both with energy work and with anybody who claims to be a psychic medium or intuitive. Do your research to make sure that they're legit. There is no sort of blanket system of, you know, like the FDA we have here in the States, or certification. Yeah. There's no certified organic, you know, medium, psychic, or healer. I compiled on my website something I call Jenny's List, where people will reach out to me and ask about practitioners. I certainly don't know all of them, but I have spent years interviewing them, so I've compiled a lot of data and research, and I love to connect the dots to resources. But there are a lot of people out there that don't either do it for the right reasons or don't know completely what they're doing, especially in the energy work space. I've seen some in Reiki in particular. Everyone thinks they can just hang a shingle because they took one class, and it's a lot more extensive than that. It should be taken seriously like education. You have to really learn it. Some people are born with it and they can just do it and be done with it, but that's kind of rare. You really have to work at it to make sure that your gifts are honed in and that they are serving others in the best way possible.
Yes, absolutely. That's an excellent point that you make there, yes.
What kind of energy work is it that you do once a month, if you don't mind asking?
Matrix energetics.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
okay.
It's amazing. And it's really freed up some blockages in my life for me, let's say that. It's been really great.
If people could see what energetically, you know, the universe can see, and that's the other thing. It's like we have these capes that we wear over us with all of our belief systems and maybe some stress that have happened, tears in our aura, whatever it might be. And I say this because James Van Prague, who wrote Talking to Heaven, Reaching to Heaven, he's a pretty well-known psychic medium here in the States. He told me if there's one thing we could understand is that if we walk through a space unconsciously, we literally pick up energetic forms. It's sort of like the lint that gets on our, you know, on our cape. And if we could imagine a lint roller just going all around our energy field to get it off and watch it. Just sort of take a light shower and watch it go down the drain back into the center of the planet for healing, because we pick it up not on purpose. It's just walking around and other people's stuff flies into our energy field and it gets muddy and murky and you have to go through the car wash every once in a while. And that's what you're doing once a month. You're going to your car wash. So I recommend that everybody get some sort of tune-up as they can. Well, I'm so grateful for the time, Penny, and for all of your research. For anyone out there who wants more information on Penny, go to her website, drpennysartori.com. Her book is The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences, and it's chock full of research. I highly recommend going on her site. You can also check her out on YouTube. There are many videos there. But Penny, keep researching, and if you have another book coming out, please reach out. And how can we get you to the States?
Oh, I'd love to come out there. That would be great. We've just released another book, actually. I've co-authored it with Kelly Walsh.
Fantastic.
And it's called The Transformative Power of Near-Death Experiences.
Fabulous. The Transformative Power of Near-Death Experiences, co-authored by Penny. Okay, we will look out for that one as well. I will be inhaling it, and then maybe we can have another conversation about that research if that works for you.
Yes, that would be great. Yes. Oh,
thank you. Again, keep doing what you're doing, and I'm so grateful for the time. And for anyone out there who's listening, treat others the way you'd like to be treated. Remember, those small little gestures of kindness make such a huge difference. And stay spiritual, damn it. I'm Jennifer Weigel, and we will talk with you next time.